My name's Scott Redmond. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi,
everybody. I'd like to thank Harlan and Susan for helping Nancy and I to get here, and I'd like to thank everybody associated with this function and all the other speakers. I'd like to thank. This has been great for me so far. I got to hang out with a lot of friends, a lot of people I really love. Terry and Cheryl are here, and people that I've been out in retreats with, and I feel just right at home at Seaside Arg. And I'd like to thank the most important guy in my life today, and that's Jim, the guy who picked me up at the airport and took me to see that big-ass spruce tree y'all got, you know? That is a big tree, man. That is a big, big tree. What? Want me to get closer to it? All right. Big tree. All right. If you're new, I'd like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a great life today, and if you're new, I'm sure that thrills the shit out of you. I'm sure you're very excited for me. Yeah, because I was just so thrilled to death for the people having a good time in AA when I got here. I'd sit and hear him talk about the new house and the wife and the car, and you know, and I'd sit in my seat and I'd think, well, geez, you know, maybe you go home tonight and maybe, you know, your house will blow up. Maybe your family will blow up, and maybe you'll blow up. Then we'll see just how spiritual you are next week. So if you know, I'd like to welcome you to AA. If you're anything like me and you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, you're looking around this room tonight and you're saying to yourself, Alcoholics Anonymous, how did I wind up in Alcoholics Anonymous? How lame is this? This is beyond lame. This is lamer than church, lamer than synagogue. This is some plateau of lameness I never even imagined was available to me. Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome. Welcome. Yeah, you're with the lames now, baby. That's right. We're glad you're here. You are now privy to an unending, unsolicited reservoir of information and advice. Because they are going to get right up in your face and talk that long AA crap to you if you are new. Usually a guy with one tooth with a cavity in it. You know the guy. You know the guy's got a belt buckle large enough to serve a whole fish on it, right? Right? You know him, right? You know him. Do I want what you've got? No. No, but thanks for sharing. Yeah, I'd like to welcome you if you're new. I'd like to thank all the people running around with white ribbons. Those are the people who want to stay sober. You know, those are the people running around doing service in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new here, I just want to tell you, if they had told me that the top of the pops, the main title here was Child of God, and that if you really succeeded at this thing, you got to do a lot of free work, I don't think I would have lingered very long, but I didn't understand that. I didn't understand that when I got here. If you don't have alcoholism yet, I'd like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. We'd love to give it to you. I didn't have it when I got here. I was not an alcoholic when I got here. If you're a drug addict, I'd like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're a dope fiend, which is somehow worse than any of us, I'd like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, if you're the Bigfoot of dope addicts, you know. You know, if you're a dope Goliath, I'd like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And just suggest that you stick, just catch alcoholism. You can have anything else you want, but just in addition to it, catch alcoholism. Because we don't have a book for dope Goliath. We have a book for alcoholism. I didn't have it when I got here. And if you don't have it, they're going to lie to you and tell you you can't catch it, and it's a lie. I caught it at these meetings. I caught it from you people. Dr. Paul is fond of saying that the infection happens at the meetings and it enters through the ear. Isn't that the truth? Isn't that the truth? It enters through the ear, spreads throughout your entire body, start infecting other people, give it to your family, the whole deal, you know? I did not have alcoholism when I got here. First of all, I'm Jewish, and Jews don't drink because it might dull the pain. Yeah, you don't want that to happen. You want to be present for any agony opportunity that presents itself. I got here, one of the first things I heard in a meeting, a guy said he was an ex-Catholic, which meant that he didn't believe in God and was positive God was going to come kill his ass for feeling that way. And I said, yeah, I'm with that guy. I mean, I understood that absolutely. In addition to being Jewish, I was not an alcoholic. I had been in psychotherapy for 18 years. I was going to be dead, but I was going to understand it. And by the time I got to AA, and I'm not putting therapy down. Therapy's great stuff. It says on page 133 of our book, if you need a doctor, well, by all means, go get one. But what I was doing, I was involved in a colossal blunder. I was trying to treat my alcoholism with psychotherapy. And man, it's confusing, because I was doing good work in therapy, and yet I was dying from alcoholism. If alcoholism is in fact a threefold illness, if it's a bizarre physical reaction to alcohol that dooms me to have little or no control over how much I drank once I put any inside me, and this bizarre physical allergy is mixed with some fascinating thinking. Some fascinating thinking. What happens is this thinking, this bizarre thinking, dooms me to continue to take the first drink, no matter the attendant misery and suffering that follows every time I do it. And because I'm doomed to take the first drink, and doomed to continue drinking because I have little or no control, then I have to rearrange my entire life, my views about morals, religion, sex, politics, everything's got to be rearranged to accommodate this weird thing. And I start developing this cancer of the soul, this soul sickness. And it eats alcoholics up from the inside like a tapeworm and leaves them insane, alone, and hollow, and dying. And you see, I was trying to treat this threefold illness, this spiritual, mental, physical illness, with psychotherapy. Psychotherapy would be mental, which would be one-fold. So I was trying to treat a threefold illness with one-fold, two-fold short. Right? Kind of like showing up to a gunfight with a knife. I was unprepared. I was unprepared, and I didn't even know it because I didn't have alcoholism. In addition to being a therapy patient, I was not an alcoholic. I was a dark, complicated, adventurous artist. But not an alcoholic. I was not an alcoholic. I was a artistic Jewish patient, I guess, is what I was by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. So if you're new here and you don't have alcoholism yet, please stick around, and I'm just going to urge you to do this. Stick around long enough to get a diagnosis. I grew up in the Bronx in New York City. Anybody from the Bronx? Nobody here with the Witness Protection Program even? Nothing? No, there he is, and he's raising his hand. You really know he's from the Bronx, right? Yeah, I'm with the Witness Protection. My family was nuttier than a fruitcake. My wife never believed me about my family, really, until she met him. My mom threw an engagement party for us, and my aunt came and wore her wig backwards, and it had a bun on it. And it wasn't a mistake. It was a look she was going after, you know? Nuttier than fruitcakes. My aunt took a decorate. Anything you got for free in my family meant it was stolen. My uncle was a welder, and he used to get these free bales of steel wool. And my aunt took a decorating course and made throw pillows and filled all the throw pillows with the steel wool. Now, after a while, that stuff works its way through on you. So when you'd go to their house and you'd look around, everybody was moving just a little bit. You know what I mean? There was a little spin on the room, you know? Up, down, moving, all the... This is a memory. I didn't remember this until like 2 months ago. My mother used to go back through the back of the New York Post and find these experiments they were running on brothers younger than 11 years old, no more than 2 years apart. They give you $15 at Montefiore Hospital. And they'd attach electrodes to you and, you know, sit you in this room for a while. And she'd page through and go, "Boys, I think I've got an experiment for you." It was like being in a bad Bugs Bunny cartoon, you know? I mean, I was trying to think about this the other day, about looking for an experiment for my kids. You know, I never saw any of that money either, which pissed me off a little bit. But if you're new here, all I have is good news for you. Because my family did not have one single solitary thing to do with making me an alcoholic. I said not one single solitary thing to do with it. And let me tell you what I mean. If you're new here and you got a nutty family, and I'm telling some of the funnier stories, but it was a mess, you know? Let me tell you what I mean, because you might be sitting out there and you're new and thinking, you know, and feeling bad about, you know, where you come from and your people and stuff like that. And what I mean by this is, if alcoholism is a threefold illness, if it is this bizarre... can you ask them to be quiet? Is that possible? Thank you. If it's this bizarre combination of these three elements working in concert with each other, and my family has messed me up psychologically, I cannot go to psychotherapy and work out my family problems and drink properly. It can't happen. I'm not saying that there wasn't damage done. I'm not saying don't take care of it. I had to take care of it. I'm saying they didn't make me an alcoholic, and no amount of work on those things will cure me of my alcoholism. Will get me free from that bizarre. And you know, that's good news for me, because therapy had become my God, and I was looking to that to really set me free, because just, you know, things never ever worked out right. They just never did. And I grew up in this family, and my dad felt that he was a loser, and I completely agreed with him. I thought he was a sap and a sucker, you know. And the fact is my father never, you know, my brother and I never missed a meal and never went to school with ripped clothing. And my father never made more than $10,000 a year. My last year out there, I made $80,000. My children did go to school with ripped clothing, and they did miss meals. How does such a thing happen? Put those two pictures down right next to each other. How does my dad come up a loser? How can such a thing happen? It happens if a certain kind of thinking becomes established in you, and you have placed yourself beyond human help, and you have so rearranged your point of view, the way you consider winning and losing, what that means. You've so rearranged it that you could look at a guy like my dad and say, "Man, you're a sap." You know? And I grew up in this family, and I had a tough time growing up in the Bronx. A lot of bad stuff happened to me as a kid. I thought that this psychotherapy thing was really going to help me dodge alcoholism. I thought this self-knowledge would really help me out, you know? And I was becoming a very well-analyzed corpse, is what was happening to me over a period of time. And the second thing I did to avoid catching alcoholism was, I drank till I didn't want to be a drunk, and I overcame my alcohol problem with marijuana. I'd like to welcome all the pot smokers here tonight. You remember WOW, right?
WOW. WOW. And right after WOW usually came, "What? What? What? WOW.
What?
WOW.
What?" Watching a pot smoker is like watching a dog try to run on linoleum, you know? There's like a lot of activity, but no movement, man. But there is a lot of shit going on there, you know? But nothing catches. There's nothing's moving forward at all, you know? I triumphed over marijuana with pills. I was victorious over pills with cocaine. Cocaine's a very good drug. It's especially good for sex if you enjoy sex from the Neolithic period. I got rid of that cocaine habit with heroin. Heroin's a good, dark, complicated artistic drug, and then you cross the line and become a vomiting pig. Just a little hop, skip, and a jump. And then I got rid of that heroin. You don't want to do that too long. And drank till I didn't want to be a drunk. And I swapped addictions and went to psychotherapy and avoided catching alcoholism until alcoholism almost killed me. If you're new here, there just ain't a more bizarre disease that you can catch. If you don't catch it, it kills you. And if you catch it, you get better. And if you're new here, I hope you stick around long enough to catch it. I was in my early 20s, and I had was in a cycle where I was using hypodermics and drugs, and I shot some heroin, and my father had a massive stroke, and I was stoned on heroin the night that he died. And I felt like a pig, like an animal. I had holes in my arm, the curtain was down, I couldn't be there for him, for my mother or my brother, and my father was lost to me. I couldn't walk into a hospital. I couldn't hear a heart machine. I couldn't think about him. I couldn't talk about him. I couldn't look at pictures of him. I certainly couldn't look at home movies of him. I was a bankrupt failure as a son. And I swore I would never put a needle in my arm again, and I didn't for 13 years. Shortly after my father died, I met a remarkable woman, a beautiful, beautiful, very, very intelligent woman. She was exotic. She was from Detroit. And to me, that was exotic, man. I had never been out of the Bronx, you know? And I just fell in love with this woman. I just adored her. We just got sicker and sicker together. We really had a lot of great ideas about what we wanted to do with our life, and we had a lot of hope, and we had a lot of warmth and a lot of empathy for each other. And then alcoholism started working on us, you know? And we became so sick, Nancy and I together. At one point, a guy lent us his car, and we sold his car. I will never forget this guy's voice on the phone as long as I live. He said, "You sold my car? I lent you my car. How could you sell my car?" That's like house sitting for someone and they come back and you're in escrow. Right? And you're proud of what you've done. The alcoholic life becomes the only normal one. That's what Silkworth says, and he's right. Got to rearrange your life to accommodate alcoholism, to accommodate the walk to the drink, because I'm always going to take it. You know, it was the end of the month. We didn't have money. I looked in my wife's eyes. I said, "Sweetheart, I am so sick of acting like a kid and borrowing money. Let's stand on our own 2 feet. Let's sell the car." And she looked at me with tears in her eyes and said, "Let's do." 16 years later, when I called this guy to pay him back, his voice was exactly the same. He said, "You're paying me back?" He was a lot more surprised with the second call. I know I was, I'll tell you that. Nancy and I had two sons, and when our older son was born in New York, we were surrounded by friends and family and flowers. There was a ton of phone calls, and he was welcomed into this world, our son Micah. 2 years and 9 months later, when our younger son Jesse was born, there was nobody at the hospital. There were no flowers, no friends, no phone calls. We had been completely isolated by the disease of alcoholism in 2 years and 9 months. The ice around our heart had become so thick, it had repelled everyone around us. And it's not that people didn't love us. It's that it hurt too much to be with us. And Jesse was not welcomed into this world. Not that way. If you're a child in my active alcoholic home, if you get in between me and the drink, it doesn't matter what I say over here. It only matters what happens over here. It does not matter what I say over here. because that bicycle money might have to go for something else. And I might be telling the truth over here, but it just is an out-and-out lie by the time I get over here. And if you're in between me and the drink and you're my kid, you either have to turn to paper mache and become something less than human for me to treat you like this, right? Or you have to disappear. How much vanishing can a child bear before they believe what they're being taught, which is that they don't exist, and they become transparent, and they live in this kind of half-lit world where things work out, don't work out, this bizarre world of the active alcoholic home that we had. And that's what our children, their lives became more and more transformed by it. They became more and more warped by it. And by the time I got sober, our older son was making these involuntary clicking noises he couldn't stop making, you know, grinding his teeth, reading years below his grade level, writing years below his grade level, crushed up and cut off from the society of other children. And I had yet to catch alcoholism. On April 20th, 1985, I put a needle in my arm again. I did because it was there. I had no mental defense against it. And I crossed the line I swore I would never cross again. And I called my therapist of record, my first Jungian therapist, and I told him what I had done, and he said to me that morning, "There's absolutely nothing that can be done for you." I said, "What?" Said, I can't do anything for you. The only thing I can suggest is you attend a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous, or we have you institutionalized. Once I was to come in here and read our book, I was to find out that Carl Jung played no small role in the founding of Alcoholics Anonymous. There was an American millionaire named Roland Hazard, and he was dying from alcoholism. And he was rich enough to call Carl Jung in Vienna and put himself into analysis with one of the fathers of modern psychology. And he went there, and he was analyzed by Jung, and he drank right away. And he went back to Jung and he said, "Is there no hope for me?" And Carl Jung said to Roland Hazard, "There's absolutely nothing that can be done for you." What an astounding thing to say. What an incredible thing for a doctor to say. What an incredibly humble thing to say. He could have said, "Come on up, man, let's talk about it." And I could be dead. You know? But therapy, which had become my God, had abandoned me. Why I went to that first AA meeting, I don't know. I couldn't tell you. Why I stayed, I don't know. If you're new here, perhaps I stayed because I'm out of plans. If you're new here, I pray for you that you're out of plans. If you are new here and you have a plan, it is probably a beaut. Don't use your plan. Don't use your plan. Grab one of us after the meeting and tell us the plan. We want to know the plan. Don't use the plan. That's actually the book I've always wanted to see, is The Collection of Newcomer Plans. That's the one I want to see, pal. That's the one I want to see. That sucker will have some diagrams in it, I'll tell you that. Look like those cocktail napkins. You know those cocktail napkins with the lists and the plans on them, man. And I walked into that AA meeting and I sat down and I looked around and I said, "Alcoholics Anonymous. How did I wind up in Alcoholics Anonymous? I'm a major guy. What am I doing in Alcoholics Anonymous?" And I hated you, man. Everybody was a miracle, you know. The furniture's a miracle. The coffee's a miracle. Oh, so wonderful. Oh, I could not believe it. But I guess I was out of plans, and I kept coming back, and I hated you. And you see, the kind of bully I am, I'm a nice guy. I'm a sterling human being. I'm a hell of a nice guy. That's why I've always tried to bully people into doing what I want them to do, you know? So they come up and talk that AA crap to me, and I'd grin and nod and pray that their face would burst into flame, you know? I'm here. I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. My life is over. All right? Now I got to listen to this guy. I mean, I couldn't believe it. And I stuck around. I kept coming back, man. I kept coming back. My wife reached out to the Al-Anon family groups. And One of the most single hurtful and confusing things to me as a newcomer in Alcoholics Anonymous was I heard people telling Al-Anon jokes. I'm not talking about good-natured jokes. I'm talking about mean-spirited jokes. And because God knows we tell enough jokes about alcoholics. I'm not talking about that stuff. And for me, it was very confusing and very hurtful because my wife had reached out to Al-Anon, was getting her own miracle, and it was kind of rekindling my feeling of any kind of pride in my wife. And I was confused by it until I stuck around long enough to know that the people who were doing that were ignorant and didn't know what they were talking about. I judge no man. And if you are doing that, then you're casting your vote. We all get one vote. I used to get all the votes. I'm down to one now. And if you are doing that, I guess you're casting your vote that on a public level that's okay to do. And tonight I get to cast only one vote, just the Scott Redmond vote. My vote's that it's not okay. My vote is that it's not okay. And the reason why I'm casting the vote that it's not okay is that there might be a newcomer out there who might be thinking what I was thinking when I'd hear it, because I'd think, isn't this a good thing? What's this about, man? Everybody's talking about dignity here. Everybody's talking about getting back some self-respect. Isn't the family, don't we want to like bring this deal back together? Because I never thought our family was going to come back together. We used to go to Nancy's sponsor's house, and man, they showed us what a sober family looked like. And I used to look around at Nancy's incredible Al-Anon sponsor and her husband, the sober man, who had been sober a long time. I'm watching them with their two daughters, and I'd say, not for us. Not for us. It's too busted up. The boys are too sick. It's too broken. Nancy and I are too broken together. We arrange too much. We rearrange too much to accommodate alcoholism. There's no way this can get straightened out. But I kept coming back. I kept coming back to meetings. And by the time I was 6 months sober, I was receiving the gift of step none. You all know the gift of step none.
Nothing.
The gift of step none is nothing. I thought I had worked the first three steps. I admitted I was an alcoholic. That's a fatal illness, you know. That my life was unmanageable, that my life was a mess, that I come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity, not that he would or should, but that it was possible, right? And I at the same time admitted that I was out of my mind, right? And that I had decided to turn my will and my life over to the care of power of God as I understand him. Now, it says in our book, it says the third step will have little permanent or lasting effect unless immediately followed by a strenuous effort to face and to be rid of the things that have been blocking me. In other words, if I don't do a fourth step, this is not my opinion, it's in that wacky blue book. If I don't do a fourth step, the third step's not going to really be with me, it's going to kind of come and go. So all I had really done was admitted I was dying, my life sucked, and I was out of my mind. How come I didn't feel any better? Why should I have felt any better? After a while, I mean, granted, when you first do those first couple of steps, man, I got the rush I felt a part of until the resentments, the fears, and the sexual problems, and the soul cancer, and the brain fever, and that big, you know, that untreated alcoholic vein pumping like a garden hose on your forehead. You know that one, right? And I was 6 months sober, and I knew I was going to drink, man, because I was here long enough to see the drill. Don't work any steps, get to the podium, get nuttier and nuttier, share your sickness, and share your way right out the door. Right. I had seen the drill, I had seen it over and over again. I had seen, you do the work, you stick, you don't do the work, you go. I had just seen it over and over and over again, and I knew I hadn't done anything. And Alcoholics Anonymous had reared its head in our life. The boys were getting a little less frightened. Things were getting a little more consistent. Money was winding up back in the house. Nancy had reached out to Al-Anon. And despite me, the program was starting to rear its head. My wife has since then told me that I did change early on. I didn't feel it, you know. And so I asked the guy to sponsor me. Man, this guy talked about God and he didn't sound like a sap, you know, and I watched this guy real careful, man.
He had been a bad guy. I knew he had been a bad guy.
You know when you look in their eyes, you see them little bunny rabbits and antelope hopping around, you know, in there? You know, I knew this guy had been a bad guy, and I knew he wasn't anymore. And I asked him to sponsor me, and he made sure that I had done some reading in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and then he invited me to his apartment, and he spent hours with me. Hours one day, for fun and for free, and I couldn't figure out why he was doing it. And he showed me a lot of care and a lot of attention. He was very kind to me. And he read chapter 5 to me, and on the way through, he took me through the first two steps. We reached step 3, we made a decision together and got on our knees and prayed together. Certainly something I had never done in my life. And then he finished chapter 5 and then went back and gave me instructions on how to do a fourth step from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, you hear some people say, and I know it's true for them, that they mostly resented themselves. I know it's true for them, and I know it's absolutely untrue for me. I hated me, but nothing compared to how much I hated you. I hated you so much more than I hated me, it's difficult to describe it. I am not a suicide person. I'm a homicide person, all right? I vastly prefer your death to mine. I always have. And I am not knocking the suicide people, all right? This is not a knock, because it's kind of the flip side of the same coin in a way, you know? But I figure I kill all of you, I got no reason to commit suicide, you know? So I'm way ahead of the game. I did that inventory in 3 months, and I went back to my sponsor at 9 months of sobriety, and I read him my fifth step, and again, this man spent hours and hours and hours with me. And afterwards, I did 6 and 7 for the first time, and then it came time to do my eighth step list. The best reading of the eighth step I have ever heard in my life took place at my old home group, and it was done by a guy who I had never seen before, and I've never seen him since. His name was Nino, and I'll never forget him. He was there with a hospital group, he had a hospital bracelet on, and he had never read chapter 5 before, and he read it for the first time that night. And he got up to that podium, and he hit step 8, and he read, "Made a list of all those we had harmed, and became willing to make amends to them all." Jesus Christ! And he looked out into the room as if to say, "Have you seen this? Do you know what's in here, man?" Oh, it was so beautiful. It was so pure, man. It's all I saw the first time I saw the steps. No, not those people, not that money, man. I wouldn't have taken that much money. Not if I knew I had to give it back. No way. Not the car. Oh, man. Oh. If you're new here, don't worry. It's 8 steps from where you are anyway, for God's sake. Man. And it's really not 8 that you got to worry about. It's 9. 9's the one that's going to piss you off a little bit, but... Time to do my 8-step list. I had to put my wife and kids down there. What was I going to do? All right, let's see. I'll sit down with the boys and say, "Gee, boys, sorry you've had no life. Forgive me." I'll sit down with my wife and I'll say, "Geez, hun, sorry about this 8-year trip to Hades." Okay? I don't want to put my dad down there. He was dead. My sponsor said, "Do you owe him an amends?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Put him down." I said, "Don, what am I going to do?" Don said, "Scott, I don't know. I don't know. You do your job in Alcoholics Anonymous and you see what happens." I put him down. I had to start acting like a father. I had to start showing up. I had to start doing lame stuff. Had to start showing up at flag football games and Little League games. I didn't show up to a lot of them, but I showed up to some. I did some coaching. I coached some flag football, and I showed up. My wife came to the games a couple of times, the baseball games, and there'd be everybody in the stands, and there'd be me pissed off, right? On the first baseline. I'm here. I'm here, okay? I'm making amends. I'm here. doing my job. I'm showing up. Here.
Took me 2 years to get over with the other people, man. It took me two. But I tell you, I'm glad I started pissed off on the first baseline alone standing in the sun. It took me a couple of years to get over there. And what happened was, as I started to do the work in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, as the noise stopped in my head, as the noise started melting down, I was able to go and talk to other people. And I was able to just be another dad hanging out in the stands and start to show up for my boys. And when I came into AA, I heard a lot of stuff I wanted and I heard a lot of stuff I didn't want. I heard people talking about their brain in the third person as if it was some unwanted alien dashing about their house planning their death. And I said, gee, I feel that way right now. Do you have anything else? And as a matter of fact, the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous in step 10 says sanity will have been restored. The alcohol problem will be removed. I won't even be cocky. It'll be gone. It says in step 11, the occasional hunch or inspiration will actually become a working part of the mind. It doesn't say I have to live like my head's out to get me. It says completely the opposite. It says that if I'm out of self, and if I'm in contact, and if I'm doing what I'm supposed to do, that I'm going to get relief from that for the first time in my life. Those voices that 18 years of psychotherapy barely took an edge off of. Because the more you lead the double life that's described in step 5, the double life that we all lead, the face that we present to our fellows and the face that we know that we have, and we do these things and we crush them down with more drinking, it adds a voice and another voice and another voice and another voice. You know, I was a couple of weeks sober, and my first two weeks in Alcoholics Anonymous, I kept saying to myself, I haven't hurt my kids. They've hurt their kids. I haven't hurt my kids. And 2 weeks into sobriety, and I was ready to take a walk. I was on the phone with a guy, and just out of nowhere, this memory came to me that just leveled me. And I remember that a couple of months before, I had been with my older son. I was hungover, and I got sick in front of him, and in response, he got sick. And what happened to me on the phone that morning was I realized, and it was crystal clear to me, that the only reason my beautiful blonde boy, my perfect, perfect little boy got sick was because he was with his father. If he had not been with his father, he would not have gotten sick. He didn't eat bad food. He didn't have a virus. He was with me. And that helped me stay here, I want to tell you. That deflated me at depth enough just to stick around a couple of more one days at a time. If you're new here, I want to tell you, and this is just something I'm going to tell you, and I'm only just one drunk. I don't talk better. I just talk more, you know. If you're new here, I think you're in a very, very dangerous situation. Because what we're basically telling you is, if you're beyond human help and you need a spiritual experience to stay sober, we know you haven't had it yet, but don't drink. That you're in this bizarre half-lit kind of world where you don't have the thing you need, but we're going to ask you to stick around long enough to get it. And sometimes a newcomer will say to me, you know, well, drinking is the furthest thing from my mind. And I want to tell you why I'm totally unimpressed with that. And I want to tell you, I'm not knocking you, and I'm not putting you down. What I'm going to tell you is, the entire Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous is engineered around the fact that when you drink, it will be the furthest thing from your mind. And if you don't do something about it, yeah. This bizarre disease that only Alcoholics Anonymous has had an aggregate of some a massive amount of recoveries where other methods have failed. But it doesn't say, you'll start thinking about a drink. You'll see it. It'll be a little tiny drink over there. The next day, you'll think about it a little more. That sucker will be a little bit bigger. It'll get a little bit bigger every day, and you'll see the hear that coming. It's coming in, man. The drink's coming. I'm thinking, it says, boom, you're drunk. It says, boom, you're drunk. Boom, you put whiskey in your milk. Boom, you cross that threshold of the hotel, and you say, man, a couple of cocktails would be great with dinner. You know? And so, again, I'm not knocking you. I'm not putting you down. I'm just telling you, if drinking's the furthest thing from your mind, that's fine. But that's what our book is about. Our book is about this bizarre mental twist that once we're in the throes of it, once we've been warped by this alcoholic insanity, it seems that nothing else, nothing besides this power greater than yourself, which these spiritual tools, not spiritual weapons, spiritual tools, are engineered to try to pull us out of. So I started doing my job in Alcoholics Anonymous. I
kind of fancied myself a show business big shot by the time I got here. By the time I got to AA, I had a book on the bestseller list, and I had acted in a Broadway play, and had directed a movie, and directed a TV show, and I had had my own theater in New York. I had done all of these things a ton. I never got to do any of them more than once, because when I'd leave, they'd move the business, you know, so I couldn't find it again. And when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a writing job for 20th Century Fox, and I turned a year sober. I was, you know, kind of becoming sort of a spiritual behemoth, you know, and I was up to direct a situation comedy. I really wanted this job, and I didn't get the job, and I almost drank. And I couldn't believe it, man. I went to my sponsor, and I said, you know, I told him what I had done, and Don said, well, you know, Scott, I guess you got that show business God, you know, you got the show business God, you know. I came to AA, and I heard people talking about God getting them jobs, getting them fired, getting them in a relationship, God getting them parking spaces, you know, not the parking God, not the parking God, you know, what if you don't get a space? I had the show business God. And he said, you know, you're going to have to sit down and write an inventory. And I did. I wrote it down, Steph. And I went in step 6 and 7, which had become kind of my template of my relationship with God. And Don said, you're going to have to ask him what you're going to have to do to stay sober. And I did step 6 and 7, and I prayed, and I said, Father, you can have show business too. All right? You can have it too. I'm done. I'll do anything. I'm willing to do anything for a living. Just don't let me drink. You can have this too. And within 3 months, I was working as a cook on a catering truck, and I looked up to God, and I said, I didn't mean this. I did not. We've had a grotesque misunderstanding. In L.A., when they shoot a TV show or a movie, they got a caterer that follows them around, man, and you make good dough. It is a good job, but hey, I'm Scott Redmond. Love you, baby, right? I can't be doing such nonsense, you know, working, getting paid, bringing the money home. So my first day catering on this movie, the executive producer and star of the movie was a guy who I had worked with in the business, and he stuck his head on that kitchen truck that morning, and he said, can I have a burrito, Scott? And I turned around, I said, what's happening, man? He said, is this your truck? I said, no, but it's my spatula. I went home, I called my sponsor, I said, oh, we're getting the gift of sobriety now, babe. Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, it's a miracle. It's a miracle. He said, sounds like you've got a resentment. What? Tutorial workshop for this stuff, right? You better sit down and write, pal. I'm resentful at Scott for working on a kitchen truck. It affects my self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, personal relations, and sex. A five-bagger for sure. Now, what am I going to ask God to take away? What? The truck? The guy? The burrito? What am I going to ask God to take away? It's no big deal, right? Resentment's no big deal. It's just the source of all spiritual illness, the great destroyer of all alcoholics. It'll cut you off from the sunlight of the spirit and kill your ass dead. But don't be alarmed. Don't be alarmed. It's okay. I'm going to die. I'm going to die. This is life and death. What am I going to do? What's blocking me? Blue skies. God's got a magic wand. He comes down and touches me on the head. What poison in me, if it was removed, this thing would be gone and I could live. I'm ashamed. I'm ungrateful. All right, I got a job, man. I'm making dough. Guys sober up, they don't even get work. All right? False pride. Grandiose. All right. Impatient. Things aren't moving along. Not trusting in God. Playing God. Things aren't going according to the Scott Redmond program. A fabulous program.
This is what I had to take to my God in step 6 and 7. I also had a resentment against God for putting me on the kitchen truck. God had woken up that morning and said, "Let's keep Saturn on its axis and get the Redman boy. Get him. Get the Redman boy. Keep all the atoms in the galaxy together and get the Redman boy." It's so bizarre. This thinking is so bizarre that's what's happening. That's what. So I go to God in step 6 and 7 and I say, "Father, please take it away." I don't say,
"Take it if you can, big guy."
I don't say, "Take it, you rotten son of a bitch." I say, "Father, please, I just can't bear this anymore. Can you please help me? Can you please? This hurts so much." And then, if I'm ready, I'll ask the biggest question I have ever asked or ever will ask as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. "Father, what can I do for you? What can I do for you? Will you do my work? I'll do your work." When we drew close to him, he revealed himself to us. All right? This is how I draw close to him, you know? What can I do for you? If my God's not big enough to handle this, what service can I do? And my sponsor, man, he said something to me early on I'll never forget, and I've had the honor of saying it to other men. He said to me about some stuff that was really troubling me, because this cooking thing, man, drove me nuts, because it kept I wound up serving people that had been my assistant directors. I wound up serving actresses I had directed in television shows, you know, and I dragged my ass in, and Don and I were talking. He said to me one time, he said, "Scott," because he knew that the secret for me was step 6 and 7. How was I going to get relief? Where was I going to find the key? What was service was going to make God big enough that he could do this too, you know, for me? And Don said to me, "Scott, if your God's not big enough, use mine." He said, "Use mine until yours is big enough." And what an incredible, loving, generous, remarkable thing to do. Now, Don knows that his God can't keep me sober, but he was saying, "I'm here, buddy. You lean on me. You use my stuff. You don't have any stuff right now. You use mine. I'll need yours eventually. You use mine today." You know. And I continue to cook. And, man, I was able to help some guys out. You know, and I wound up being a real good cook and real proud of the work that I was able to do. And both of the companies I cooked for asked me to go into business with them, and I learned how to hold my head up and be a responsible example of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was an astounding experience. One of my friend Paul, was going through a humbling experience, and he used to have a prayer that he shared with me. He used to say to God, "Father, please help me. I'm willing to do anything, but please don't let it be as bad as what you did to Scott." And I was just so thrilled to be of some help to him. This other guy, my sponsors, used to be a real big rock and roll star. He was a couple of years sober, and he was out in the San Fernando Valley. He got a job digging fence post holes. And this other guy that Don sponsored was with him. This kid's about 17 years old, and Dave and this guy, they're digging these fence posts, you know. And all of a sudden, the kid just cracks up. He cannot stop laughing. And my buddy says to him, "What the hell are you laughing about?" And the kid says, "You know, I always wanted to hang out with rock and roll stars, man, you know." So I've been cooking for a couple of years, and I got contacted by a company called Ketchum Public Relations, this big public relations company back in New York, and they kind of were, I was up for this big-time comedy writing job, and I wanted it, and the old brain fever came back. And man, I wanted it, and I started obsessing on it, and I did this videotape for them that they asked for, but I eventually just crashed and burned. Before I even heard from him, I had to sit down and write a 10-step and release the sucker, and I was fine with it. And a couple of weeks later, I get a phone call from Ketchum that I didn't have the job, and I was fine. Hung up the phone, phone rings. "It's my catering company. Can you go up to Lake Arrowhead, which is in the mountains above L.A., and cater a commercial?" And I said, "Yeah, sure." I got in the truck, and I got up there. And grabbed the call sheet, you know, which tells you, you know, all about what you got to do. And I see the company, the commercial was
Ketchum Public Relations. I'm feeding them now. Now I'm feeding them. I look down at the end of the truck, and there's a guy with a videotape camera, and he's taping me. And I said, what are you doing? He said, oh, we're taping the making of the commercial. They're taping my humiliation. They're taping my humiliation. They're going to go back to New York, and they're going to show the guys in New York, and the guys in New York are going to go, is that Scott Redman with the meatloaf? Oh, my God. That poor, miserable son of a bitch. I get off the truck, and I call Don, and I said to my sponsor, oh, we're getting the gift now, pal. Oh, are we getting the gift now, and the miracle's a little bigger. He said, you know, I guess God had enough writers and needed a few cooks today. Then he said, you know, Scott, you told God you wanted to work for Ketchum. You forgot to tell him what you wanted to do.
Man.
Well, as long as he's having a good time, folks, you know. Oh, man. My first year of sobriety, I was on line waiting to buy my lunch. There was a guy standing in front of me, and he was buying, like, you know, a can of Colt 45 with, you know, loose lint and change. You know the guy. You know, he had been there for like a week, you know. He turned around and looked at me, and instead of my best Bronx saying, what are you looking at? I said, how you doing? He said, you don't know how I'm doing. Nobody knows how I'm doing except for the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. So we went outside and we talked, and that night I went on my first real 12-step call. I got a guy with more time than me, and we were told by a city agency or some guys to take this guy down to County General Hospital and dump him off at the door. Don't go in with him. Dump him off. Don't show them that he's got any resources. Just leave him and book. We didn't. We went through the whole deal with the guy. We went all the way up to the alcoholic ward with the guy. And about halfway through, he turns to us and he says, I feel like I'm dying. And the guy I'm with said, that's cause you are. And I pulled the guy aside. I said, how could you say that to him? How could you say that? I'm scared he's not going to like us, right? How could you say such an awful, insensitive thing to this guy? And the guy is in a county facility. He's been told to lie that he's got blood in his urine to break his way into an alcoholic ward. What is the guy supposed to say? Bad day. You're having a bad day. This is not a bad day. This is what dying feels like. I'll let you know when you're having a bad day. This isn't it. And if you stick around here for any appreciable amount of time, you will see men and women walk into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous with bottoms that will make your hair stand on end. You will look at that man or woman and you will say to yourself, they'll never drink again. Not with what they've been through. Not this time. They'll never drink again. And if they don't treat their alcoholism with the program of action outlined in our book, it won't be the bottom. It'll be a bad day. Bad set of breaks. Time when people were being particularly mean to them, and they'll get on with the business of dying. And I hope and pray for you, it never stops to hit you in your heart. I hope and pray for you, it never ceases to make your blood run cold when you watch them go. You know, better you than me, yeah, fine. But the guys that I sponsor today, that who are dead today, I miss them. I loved them. When I told them I loved them, I meant it. My wife misses them, and my kids miss them. And sometime after this, one of the guys I sponsor, he ripped some people off in the program, stole some money, you know, and ripped off a car. He was making me look pretty bad. And I wanted to sit down and explain a few things to him, you know, and my sponsor said, I don't think so. So instead of telling the guy what I thought of him, I sat down and wrote, I am resentful at blank for ripping people off in AA and making me look bad. It affects my self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, personal relations, and sex. A little knock in the crotch there, a little ego blow, right? What are the defects in me? If God were to remove the resentment, would be gone? I'm self-centered. I didn't rip anybody off. He did. I'm a people pleaser. I care more about looking good in the program than what this guy's going through. I'm playing God. I can't get him drunk. I can't get him sober. And a new one, didn't get this till I came into AA and became a spiritual Goliath. I've got spiritual pride. How dare a man comport himself thusly after coming into contact with a man of my spiritual caliber? It's unbelievable. Sometime after this, this gentleman found out that he had a fatal illness. And he was told by a county agency that all they could do is take him, drop him off down to County General and dump him off at the door. And I knew that that wasn't true because I had done my job in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I guess he couldn't call anybody else because they had either told him what they thought of him or he had burnt them out. I was the last guy he could call because I had done my job in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got to be there for a man during his death, and my father came back into my life. And I felt his presence again, and I could go to the hospital again, and I could talk to him, and I could tell his grandsons about him, and I could laugh about him, and I had my dad back. My kids didn't have a relationship with my father because I couldn't talk about him. Because I did my job in Alcoholics Anonymous, and my dad had been completely lost to me for so long that when he came back into my life and I was able to talk to him again and have that again in my life, Nancy and I, as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous and the Al-Anon family groups, are no longer the family that was completely isolated, who had this baby in the hospital that nobody showed up for. Our younger son, Jesse, wound up in neonatal intensive care shortly after he was born, and I couldn't find anybody to watch our older son, and I couldn't come to the hospital. A doctor had to offer us to drop our kid off at her house so I could come, and my false pride wouldn't allow me to do it. My wife had to suffer alone because I wouldn't let a stranger show me some kindness. And what has happened as a result of us, you see, it doesn't say anywhere in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that the road gets narrower. And I understand why people say that, but I'm just somebody who likes something else. What it says, in fact, in the first 164 pages is it says, join us on the broad highway. Help us to pack things into the mainstream of life. Join us on the firing line of life. Become part of the great reality. It just talks about things getting more inclusive, not exclusive. It talks about life getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And that's what I like, man. I'm a more kind of guy. You know? And I don't like the road getting narrower. It means I think the road narrows. I can't do a lot of bad shit I used to do. Imagine my shock. But what the book says is about my life getting bigger. And I'll tell you, when I started, and I know when this happened, two of the biggest events that happened to me as a sober person, one was when I called my sponsor to discuss another man, to discuss one of the men I was sponsoring instead of me. That was a big moment for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the other equally and more and as important big moment is the day I realized that I was actually deriving joy from the good fortune of other people. And that's something that, as a drunkard, was completely lost to me. If it didn't directly benefit me, all it brought up was low self-esteem, self-pity, and man, if you could bottle self-pity, it would not crack off the market in 5 minutes. It would, man. It's a more powerful drug than crack. If you think about it, when I get full of self-pity, my eyes cloud up, I get a little lump in my throat, my shoulders lean forward a little bit. It's brandy, man. You know, for me, that's self-pity stuff. And Nancy and I had to stop working on our relationship. My idea of working on a relationship is to talk to you until you change your mind. It's to talk to you until your eyes roll back in your head and you keel over, and on the way down you go, oh, okay. We started working on bringing a better person to the deal, working on ourselves, getting closer to God, working a program, and bringing a better person to the deal. Our sexual inventory, I'm sure if you're new, it thrills you that we have a sexual inventory. On page 69 in our book, I use it as a template for my relationships in this world.
not just for sex. It says we write about 7 different points. Where have I been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Where have I unjustifiably aroused jealousy, suspicion, and bitterness? And what should I do instead? Not what could I do, what should I do? In this way, I try to shape a sound ideal for my future life. I ask God to help me walk toward it. I get to write about the guy I always wanted to be and never acted like. My whole life, I stood next to men 10 years younger than me and said to myself, I wonder what it feels like to be grown up. That's a horrible thing to feel for a grown man. And once I started doing this work, I started understanding why I didn't feel grown up. Where have I been selfish? I want what I want when I want it. Where have I been dishonest? Well, man, it was ugly. Cleaning the house. You might think I'm cleaning the house because a man, a grown man, should have the dignity to live in a clean house. No, no. I think that a certain amount of housework should equal a certain amount of sex. Right? There should be conversion tables on the back of cleaning products of housework to sex. Wow. I smell a marketing tool. Entrepreneurial spirit up there. Right? So I'm never cleaning the house because a guy should live in a clean house. I got all these agendas going on, man. What does this have to do with alcoholism? What does this have to do with it? Nothing unless you're going through it. And then it has everything to do with it because it was the work I had to do to get closer to God and start feeling like a grown man for the first time in my life. And then I could act like a grown man with my sons. And then I could be a grown man to the... And you know, it's an incredible thing. I did something that doesn't happen a lot in AA. It happens to some people. It doesn't happen to everybody. I allowed myself to be sponsored. You know, and that's a big thing, man. You don't have to. You know, this is the first... This is the only deal I know of where you're allowing someone to help you. And you can fire them. I still haven't gotten any pay stubs. I don't know where that phrase comes from, but... But that's an incredible thing. If you don't, you can get a designer sponsor, you know, you can do all that stuff. If you don't allow yourself to be sponsored, me. And I'll tell you what happened for me is a man showed me a lot of love and a lot of attention and a lot of time. And I then was able to start showing that to my family. I was able to start showing that to my wife and my children. I allowed myself to be fathered a little bit and I learned how to be a father as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was really sorry I couldn't be here last night to hear my wife talk. I love hearing her talk because I find out a little more about our marriage and about her and every time I do hear her talk. And I just, my God doesn't, and this is just for me, he doesn't care if Nancy and I are together or not. He expects me to do my job in Alcoholics Anonymous if we're together or not. But I just adore her. I just adore her. I just adore my sons. I used to wake up at night when I was drinking and I used to look at her jugular vein pumping and I used to say to myself, how can we put a stop to that? And now sometimes I wake up at night and I look at her asleep and I say, how could I live without you? I just adore you. And if you're new here, I'm not telling you if you get sober, the wife, and you get back to get. I'm just saying this is what's happened for us. And again, my God doesn't care whether or not we stay together. He expects both of us to do our job in our programs. You know, the boys. I'm not going to share about it tonight, but our older son has begun his journey into what I'm not entirely sure. But the boys were covered. And the boys recovered from the terror that they were in. And this family that had been completely isolated as a result of alcoholism, I'll just tell you, a year ago, we live in Sherman Oaks in California. And on January 17th at 4:31 a.m., we were right in the middle of the big one, you know. The quake hit, and Nancy claims that I left a footprint on her forehead getting out of bed. I think she's lying. I still think she's lying. I said my prayer. Holy shit. I got a little more spiritual later in the day. House stopped shaking. You see, I know there's a difference between spirituality and geology. Earthquakes are geology. God is spirituality. I think the people who were thrown to the lions understood that on some level that the lions were politics and God was spirituality. Because if I got a God who's up there and picks up my house and goes, figure that out, you moron. I'm in trouble. We were up in Vancouver at a function a couple of weeks after the earthquake, and this woman said to me, "Oh, I'm so glad God got us out of L.A. before that quake." And I went, "Oh, but we're crap." He got you out, but he went, "Get the Redmond boy! Get him!" And she said to me, "Well, I think he just figured you had some lessons to learn." Get me a drink! Please get me. If I had that God, man, I'd have a gallon in either hand. That's just me. That God works for her. It doesn't work for me, but I hope she's prepared when her next lesson arrives. I hope I see her afterwards. Ask how the lesson went. Last Christmas, our older son who... Well, let me just finish with the earthquake real quick. After it stopped shaking, we walked a couple of blocks from the house where a guy I sponsor who had a five-month-old baby and his wife, their place was completely destroyed, and we moved him into our place. And we walked a couple of more blocks where my sponsor lived. His place was completely obliterated, and a guy had just died in Don's arms, was just electrocuted right before we got there and passed over while Don was holding him, and his place was completely wiped out. And what happened was, is my enthusiastic, committed, loving AA family kicked in, and people just came together and started swarming apartments, moving people out, making sure people had money, had food, taking care of each other. And this family, myself, Nancy, and our boys, just had people packed in. And this is the family that was completely alone, had been completely alone, and were right in the pocket. You know, we're at this one apartment, this 20 happy, dopey drunks, moving everything out. No one's yelling. No one's bossing each other around. Everything's getting done. And this guy's neighbor is all alone. And she looks at me and says, "How do you get them? Can I get them?" You know? I said, "Well, you have to almost die, you know. Vomit a lot will come back. Last Christmas, there's a guy, my dear friend of mine, who I've stayed real close to. Our son has had some problems with drinking and drugs in the last couple of years, and I've stayed real close with this guy, and I love him. He's a guy with some time in this program who I really love and respect. And last Christmas, Christmas morning came, and Mike didn't show up, and I was starting to get pretty pissed off. Not for me, for my wife. She had gone, she had gone through a lot of trouble, and and not for me. It was for my younger son because it meant a lot to him. I certainly wasn't angry for myself, and I was getting nuttier and nuttier the later it got, and I knew I was in the toilet pretty good. And I called my friend Cliff, and I told him what was going on, and he said to me, "What do you want to do?" I said, "I'll tell you what I want to do. I know where he is. I want to go pick him up, and I want to beat the crap out of him." And Cliffy said to me that morning, "You go do that. You can do that if you want. But before you go, let me tell you, a couple of weeks ago, my 40-year-old son was at my house, and he had a tick in his eye. And I asked him where he got the tick from, and he said to me that he had gone to a neurologist, and the neurologist said the only way he could have gotten that tick was from a blow to the head." And Cliff said to me on the phone, "I know I'm the only person who's ever hit him in the head." And my violence completely went away, just absolutely evaporated. And I said to him, you know, and I thought to myself later, I said, why would a man tell another man such a thing? I mean, out there in that world, man, you know, you could stand on the shoulders of a mistake like that and make yourself a little bigger. Why would a man do that? Because he's supposed to. Because once our dark past is in God's hands, we can help others avert death and misery, because he was perfectly there for me that morning. And I said, what should I do? And he said, hang up the phone, take the third step using your son's name, and then go in and see what your family wants to do. And I followed his direction, and Nancy and Jesse said, yeah, we're sad and we're mad, but let's have us a morning. And we had a great Christmas morning. And that day, about 35 members of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon trooped in and out of our house, because that's where we are, because we live in the house that Nancy's sponsor lived in. Not the same house, but it's the house that I used to go to and say, not us. It's too broken. It's just too broken, and it can't happen here. And it's exactly where I live. If you're new here, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to suggest that you stick around long enough to get a diagnosis. Just long enough to find out if you have alcoholism. Our problem mainly rests in our mind. If it didn't mainly rest in our mind, after we got the drugs and alcohol, the alcohol out of our body, why would we ever go back and drink again? Some months ago, I was talking to a guy I'd met at a meeting. He was a couple of weeks sober. He called me that night, and he talked to me for an hour. And I said, four times, so he'd know I wasn't dead. And he described to me that he had been stalking several women, and he had a restraining order taken out against him, but it's all different now. He's got 2 weeks, and it's all different now. And at the end of the hour, he said, "I feel so all alone." And I said, "What do you mean? I just listened to you for an hour, and I hardly even know you, and I didn't interrupt you. What do you mean you feel alone?" He said, "I mean, I don't have a woman." And I said to him, "Well, what exactly would you be bringing to a relationship right now? Besides stalking skills, right?" "What are you bringing to the party, pal?" What a catch, huh? Our problem mainly rests in our mind. A while ago, I was on the phone with this guy, the new guy. Nancy's walking through our room, and as she walks through, she hears me say, "Okay, let's say the aliens are coming." Well, she stopped short. She ain't gonna miss this for nothing. I said, "That's an outside interest. I have no opinion on whether or not the aliens are coming. I just have one question for you. Why are they coming for you? Why have they traversed an entire galaxy for your sorry ass? You're 11 days sober. You have no life. Why have they gone across a universe for you? Plus, he's sleeping with a Bible on his chest to ward them off. They're going to come across a galaxy, walk into his room and go, 'Oh no, the Bible. Let's go home.'" Our problem mainly rests in our mind. If you're new here, I don't know what you're coming in with. I don't know if you've lost your dad. I don't know if you've lost your kids. I don't know if you've busted up your life. I don't know if you've destroyed your relationships. I don't know if you have the defective character of murder. I didn't have that defective character, but I have sponsored men who did. Those who have gotten sober have been able to help other people with that defect in a manner that I can't help them. Because they can look into the eyes and say with complete confidence, this thing is for you too. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome home. Thanks for having me down.